So thank you. So I'm, you know, excited to be the first experimental talk here. And I should mention, usually when I give talks, I usually have way too many slides. I never get through all of them because I have lots of questions. So today, I decided to have a lot fewer slides. So you guys really need to ask a lot of questions. Otherwise, I'm going to run out of slides. So please interrupt me whenever. I'm happy to go off topic. I'm happy to skip around. Whatever really interests you guys. So yeah, I'm from Jilla and NIST, the University of Colorado Boulder. I'm a postdoc in the group of Jun Yi. And what we work on are these really, really precise and accurate clocks. I should mention this is always confusing. What I'm going to tell you about today is primarily precision and not accuracy, but we'll get to that in a minute. This is, of course, a joint work. There's a lot of people who work on this project. And what I'm going to tell you about today is primarily work done, in addition to me, by Ross and Sarah, who are the two graduate students. Sarah's now a postdoc on the group. Aki is another postdoc. Nelson was a master student. And there's a new student who is not yet in the photo, Will. So it's a very, very good team of people doing this work. And of course, all with Jun Yi. So what I'm going to tell you about is pretty much a story of a few different quantum resources. So I'm an atomic physicist. I deal with atoms. I deal with lasers. And the first main resource that we really, really like is we have an atom with two completely different electronic states. They're incredibly long-lived. So we have some ground state, so that lives forever, and some excited state that lives for a few minutes in vacuum in principle. Nobody's actually seen that yet. But in principle, this is a few-minute excited state. And in addition to some electronic state, we have atoms that also have nuclear states. And we have about 10 of them. And so the game that we play are with these sort of 20 very long-lived states. And virtually every experiment we ever do involves taking our atom and then turning on a really, really good laser. So these atomic transitions that I'm going to tell you about are millihertz level transitions. Our lasers are nowhere near that level yet. We're about 1.5 orders of magnitude away. But the quantum resource that we have is going to be this electronic state, the nuclear state, and the final thing is emotional state. And mostly that's about getting rid of the motion of atoms. And I'll tell you about what is, this is called an optical lattice, which is why these are called optical lattice clocks. And the main story I'm going to give you today is about improving this to a three-dimensional cubic, simple cubic optical lattice, and why this is actually a really good idea. And so the resources we have really are degenerate fermions in a three-dimensional arrangement. So before I really get to that full story, I should probably tell you why we're doing any of this. Why are we building clocks out of these really good atoms? And you know, there's a lot of motivations. I mean, standards, I am officially an employee of the standards lab. So this is, of course, you know, somehow important to me. But all of our good standards are based on quantum mechanical constants and principles and systems. And time, of course, is the one that underlies it, because we're the ones who measure things best. There's a lot of applications of this, ideas in, say, measuring geophysical properties of the Earth by the way that our clocks can couple to gravity. There's ideas of measuring astrophysical and cosmological events. There's a lot of very interesting proposals from the clock side and from the atom interferometry side, like you'll hear, like this system that you'll hear later, of, say, measuring gravitational waves in these systems. One of the key ingredients for everything we do is preserving quantum information for ridiculously long amounts of time. And so there's application of using this for quantum information. But of course, what's more interesting here is fundamental physics. So can we use our systems to get a picture of what dark matter actually looks like, which of course we have nothing to fill in right now? And then there's many-body physics, which is something that's near and dear to my heart. And in a different audience, I would probably spend a long time talking about this. But this is actually something that's very, very important for our clocks. And the idea is that we have very precise measurements by putting lots of atoms into a system. Those lots of atoms are simple objects that can interact in not-so-simple, non-trivial ways that lead to emergent phenomena. And so it turns out that our clocks are very good at understanding many-body physics, and we need to understand many-body physics in order to understand our clocks. And I can talk about that easily for another hour, but I won't today. But if you have questions, please ask me later. So for fundamental physics, how is this relevant? Well, one day, we're going to hit some post-accelerator era. The LHC may be the last accelerator we're building, and we need new tools in order to study more physics, as of course Mina has of course motivated much better than I will. But there are, as you know, and as you heard, a lot of outstanding problems, but there are unfortunately very few outstanding puzzles. And what I mean by this is we know there are problems in our series because of theoretical reasons, and we know there are problems, say, with the Stern model from an astrophysical point of view, but we don't have our very good puzzles on laboratory experiments right now. There's a couple of questions that we have of things that didn't quite match the Stern model, and I believe the proton charge radius is sort of being understood as an experimental error rather than a failure of the Stern model. What we really need are more things that we can measure in a lab that show that the Stern model is wrong. We're really lacking on that. And of course, anytime I measure, I have some new theory, new physics I want to understand, when you're doing very accurate measurements, you end up with this very nice thing that if, for example, I want to detect a new particle that somebody comes up with, very often the more accurately I measure something, the larger the mass range. And typically that's in some theories, depending on your theory, that's a linear scaling. So if I can make my clock an order of magnitude better, which is what we do decade after decade, then I can extend my mass range by orders of magnitude as well. That's a little bit harder on a collider. Yeah?
Can you elaborate a little more why proton charge radius you think is experimental
error? There are several different competing measurements of the proton charge radius that are primarily. Right, so if I want, the main experiments are measuring hydrogen optical spectroscopy, measuring, for example, the 1s, 2s transition in hydrogen has been measured very, very well. But that 1s, 2s transition depends both on the proton charge radius and on the Rydberg constant. So that single measurement can't actually tell you what the proton charge radius is. So you need to complement it with different experiments. Now, initially, people compared the 1s, 2s measurement to a higher level measurement and got some to higher levels of the hydrogen atom. And that gave a measurement of the proton charge radius. And then people measured the same thing with the muonic hydrogen. They're replacing the electron with the muon, and they got very different answers. But then recently in Munich, they've redone some of the measurements for the higher, I think it's a n equals 2 to n equals 4 transition. And that is all kind of consistent with the muonic measurement. So it seems as if the old measurements of not 1s, 2s, but higher levels than hydrogen are no longer in agreement with modern day measurements. So it seems as if most of the measurements for the proton charge radius are kind of actually becoming consistent again. And so perhaps this is not a failure of the Stern model. But I can go into more detail afterward, though I'm sure there's probably some people here who are more of an expert on this than I am. I don't know if that's been published yet, but I think if it hasn't been published yet, they're very close to publishing. And so the question ultimately is what that 19th digit and beyond of our optical frequency, I mean, we can measure out to a ridiculous number of digits, what this digit can tell us about new physics, about dark matter, about beyond Stern model. And I don't actually have an answer to this. I think this is something that's sort of a very interesting question that people are starting to develop answers for. And I think we need some more ideas in the future. But this is sort of what I feel like is a strong motivator for using clocks. By clocks, I really mean precise optical spectroscopy to study new physics. So the talk is sort of as follows. I'll tell you a little bit about the background of optical glass clocks. I'll tell you about this new experiment we're working on, new experiment that we built that can see a record Q factor. I'll tell you what that is and why I care. And then some very recent unpublished experiments on atom-atom coherence, where we're getting to very, very high precision in these systems. And if there's time at the end, I'll tell you about ideas of implementing some of Mina and others' ideas for a dark matter search in our system. Without further ado, the idea of clocks, of quantum measurement in general, precise atomic measurements in general, I would say, is I have a two-level system. I'm not sure what those two levels are, but I have a two-level system, and I can measure my two-level system really, really well. And what I do is I choose a couple of states that are sensitive to something I care about. So maybe these states are sensitive to magnetic fields or electric fields, or in my case, I want to measure time really well, so these have a very large energy gap. And then you try to control these states from being sensitive to all the things you don't care about, and that is almost all of your work. That's called accuracy. So in our system, we have not only an optical clock, we also have a magnetometer, an electric field sensor, and a microphone, and a thermometer. And that's all really annoying, and we try to make it not sensitive to those things and control them. And that's most of the job. And then you use lots of atoms in order to get some precision, but not so many that you start to screw up your measurements. So like I said, in our case, the two levels we care about are electronic states of an atom. These are separated by a couple of EV, and if I write it in EV units, it's not a very, I don't get very many digits, because measuring something in EV involves comparing an energy of an atom to some kilogram ampere, so that's a stupid measurement approach. So really use Hertz units, and in this case we have a few more digits, but we're limited by the cesium standard, and that's another story. But what we do typically is we couple these two levels with the laser, and what I'm going to describe is called Ramsey spectroscopy. You couple these two with the laser for some time, and you put your atom in some quantum mechanical superposition of those two states. And we choose states that live for a long time. And then you wait. And if you wait for free, you get some phase shift that depends on the energy and how long you wait. And then you couple those systems again together, and you turn that phase shift into populations, and this is what we measure. This is a general scheme of how we measure things very precisely. So you have the number of atoms that end up in here depends something to do with the energy of your transition and the energy of your laser and the time you wait. So if you do this for 100 milliseconds, you get a pretty much perfect experiment where the number of atoms that you end up exciting somehow sinusoidally depends on, say, tuning a knob of my laser. And of course, what we do, what we like to do, is measure this for longer times. And our current record, and I believe this is currently the best in the world, is if we can do this for on the order of 6 seconds, and then still see, as we tune our laser around, we get a little bit of a signal. And this is our atoms telling us about what our lasers is doing. And just to give you an idea, I mean, 6 seconds is a ridiculously long amount of time. That's saying we put our atoms in some superposition state now. And then we see how that superposition is doing, and that tells us about the frequency of our laser. And it turns out that also means these experiments take a long time, because this is a long time to wait in the lab. If you put this in proper units, that's taking a frequency of a laser, tuning that 16th digit around, and watching our atoms sinusoidally oscillate with that. So this is the first hint as to how we get the precision that we do. That's spectroscopy. The way we build a clock is, I said, we have our two-level system for our atoms. We have our laser beam. That's some oscillating field at some frequency. And we shine the laser on our atoms. And if we do our job right, we excite our atoms. And whether or not we do our job right tells us about the laser. And so this effectively closes some feedback loop. And this is what we call a clock. So every once in a while, we can, for example, get a counter and measure the frequency of our laser. That's called a frequency comb. I will definitely not be talking about that today. And in principle, you can take that counter and you can integrate up a signal, and that tells you what time it is, which of course is never, ever close. I should really figure out one day how to get this to be consistent with the actual time, but whatever. We don't actually do, this is, I think, realistic because we don't actually do this part. We are a research lab that studies what are the elements of making a good clock. We're not a service. We don't distribute time. Those things are all hard, and other people do them. So let me sort of, yes.
Can you go back a few slides? Sorry.
Yes.
Just out of curiosity, how are, one more slide, sorry. How are you reading the slide where you actually showed the 6 second detuning?
Right, so we excite an atom. We put in some superposition state, and depending on whether it's in this state or that state, we have other states that we can couple to.
How are you reading up the data points that you showed at the end of
Right.
the slide?
So there are, we have, of course, not a two-level system. We have a multi-level system. So the transition I'm telling you about, that didn't work well, is some, I don't need to label them. I have two levels, and then I have a third level here that is only coupled to the ground state. And so we take a laser that's resonant with one of our clock states to another transition. And this is a very strong transition, something where we can scatter off at about 30 megahertz. And if an atom is in this state, we shine on this blue laser, and we scatter very, very rapidly. And if it's in this state, it doesn't couple to that laser. So we have a very, very different result in our experiment if her atom ends up in one state or the other. In one case, it gives thousands of photons that we can pick up. In the other case, it gives none. So it is a strongly projective measurement. Of course, we don't do this for one atom. We do this for tens of thousands of atoms. But we can verify, but we can get this to the point, and I'll show you later, that we can do all this at atom shot noise limits. So if we have 10,000 atoms here, we can count within square root of 10,000, 100 atoms of which state they're in. But yeah, thanks for interrupting. Those are the details I did not include in these. Because usually when I throw up a level diagram, everybody's eyes just glaze over. But please, keep interrupting. This is great. Did that answer your question? Sorry.
Yeah.
OK. So I showed you this feedback system. It's a loop, laser coupled to our atoms. And let me just sort of explain that again, because this is sort of very core and something people often miss in clocks. Let me just sort of explain that again. A couple centuries ago, if I wanted to build a clock, I took a local oscillator, which was my, you know, human-made ticking object that I try to get count seconds off of. So every second, this hand advances a little bit. And if I build one of these and somebody else builds one of them, these are both mechanical objects depending on some little pendulum inside of here, they will disagree. Everybody who builds one of them builds a slightly different frequency, has a slightly different frequency. They all tick at slightly different rates, and they all disagree. So the way that we actually manage to agree about things is we compare it to some reference that a couple centuries ago was astronomy, which is why Stern's institutes are very often associated with observatories. And so maybe once a day, you check, you know, from one high noon to the next high noon, how many ticks have elapsed. And maybe I built one that ticked 86,400 in three times, so a few more times than it should have. And I write that down, and I know how my ticking object compares to everybody else's ticking object. We still do the same thing, only instead of a mechanical object, we have an electromagnetic ticking object. It ticks every 2 femtoseconds. And instead of astronomy, we have our atoms, but it's the exact same idea. Every once in a while, we take our laser, we point at our atoms, and we see what it does. And how well that works is sort of shown here. These are the kind of graphs that us experimentalists love. This is saying, how well can I measure, how many digits do I get, let's say, if I measure for some amount of time? And for a typical, most experiments, the more you measure something, the better you do. And so that's shown here. If I measure for longer and longer time, up to about a second, I get a better and better measurement of, say, how many digits and frequency that. But this laser doesn't have a well-defined frequency. It just ticks at whatever rate it ticks. And so over time, it drifts off. And just to give you some idea of orders of magnitude here, 10 to the minus 16 turns out to be a gravitational redshift of 1 meter. So if I had two of these, and I had two lasers, and I changed their height by a meter, in a few seconds, I could compare them and say, oh, I can measure that. But if I wait too long, they start ticking at different rates, and I lose track of this measurement. So the point of the atoms is to stabilize this laser. And so what we do is every, say, second, we compare a laser to our atom, we correct the frequency of this laser, and we can keep averaging down up to some point where I don't know the frequency of my atom anymore. And so this is a total uncertainty, and this is for our paper from a couple years ago, where we're at 2 parts in 10 to the 18. It takes us about a few hours to reach that, which is very good. And if you compare it to other technologies, we're about maybe an order of magnitude faster averaging than single ion clocks, which is the main competitor. And compared to the venerable cesium fountain, in about a week of averaging, they get to where we are in 1 second. So we're doing a lot better than that. So that technology is pretty much out for precision. For the most precise frequency measurements. And again, this frequency corresponds to about a 2 centimeter gravitational redshift. So in principle, you take two of these clocks, you change the height. If you change it by more than a few centimeters, you can start to see that. And everything that goes into this point, well, I'll say that in a moment. So there are two parts of this. And let me just tell you about the two parts. I'll spend a little bit of time on the laser and then most of the time on the atoms, because that's my personal interest. For the laser, the way we make a really good laser is we make a really good length standard. So we have a laser, and what we do is we build what's called an optical cavity. We take two extremely good mirrors, and you take a laser and you have an extremely good mirror, and what happens is the light bounces back, of course. You think if you have two really good mirrors, definitely nothing is getting through. But most of you probably know, or some of you at least probably know, that if you can get an interference effect, if you make the distance between these two mirrors, or say the round trip distance, some integer number of wavelengths, or you make the distance some half integer number of wavelengths, you can get some constructive interference, and you can get the light to all magically go through. So this is how I take a length standard, and by virtue of the speed of light, I can turn that into a frequency standard. And so when we talk about a really stable laser, what we actually talk about is a really stable length standard that's called an optical cavity. How well can we do this? Well, if you build the best one, you have no idea. So of course, you always have to build two, at least. And the result from a few years ago is if I take these two and I effectively make them tick, say, 1 hertz off from each other, you can see some beating. I compare this laser to that laser that, say, over a few seconds, I have some accordion where it goes a little slower and it goes a little faster and a little slower. But the take home is over 20 or 30 seconds of the 10 to the 15 cycles per second, we know which one we're on. And that means we can start to do phase measurements. We can measure the phase in the beginning to the phase at the end with our atoms and make very good measurements. How do we get them this good? Oh, of course, I should say 16 digits of frequency stability means 16 digits of length stability. So these are typically about tens of centimeters long. And we stabilize the distance to 1/20th the radius of a proton. So that's pretty good. And this is actually an old result from a few years ago. We have about a factor of 2 on this now. I should update these slides. So how do we do that? Well, what you do is you find all the things that make the length not stable, and you make them not happen. So for example, we're in a lab, and the lab is vibrating because of either people walking around or because of the building. And so you worry. This is, for example, a schematic. This is a 40 centimeter long block of glass that we currently use. There's a little circle at the end, that's one of the mirrors. At the other end, you can't see it, is the other mirror. And this is some rigid block of glass, but it's not like infinitely rigid, unfortunately. So as this thing vibrates up and down, it kind of changes the length a little. So what you do is you mount at these very four special points, 2 points here and 2 points in the back. And if you accelerate this upwards, in the middle, it's not entirely rigid, so it can contract a little bit. You imagine you're holding some object at 2 points, and you accelerate upwards. That sort of contracts the inside. The bits on the outside are lagging, so they can sort of expand a little bit. And if you choose your points just right, you get this serpentine pattern where the expansion on the outside and the contraction on the inside exactly cancel, and you can get rid of accelerations. And then, of course, you just put this in some ridiculous amount of passive stability. You put this in vacuum. You put it on rubber. You put it on an active plate. You put it on passive plate. You put it in a room that nobody's allowed to enter, and all of that. And that does not limit us. The other thing you worry about is the temperature. As the temperature changes, things expand and contract. So this is data actually from our new system. This is a cryogenic cavity, where I'm showing 1 over the cavity length. The idea that as I cool it down, we choose a material that first contracts and then expands again. Thermally. And so if you catch it just at this turning over point, to first order, you're not sensitive to temperature changes either. Now, you're never really at the maximum. Maybe if you're a Kelvin off, you worry about temperature changes at the nanokelvin level. But that's OK, because we put in a ton of passive stability. So if I change, say, the temperature of the box that this thing lives in, we have data that shows the temperature of our cavities change over the course of a week. So it takes about 1 week for our cavity to stabilize with the lab. And that's because this is a schematic of the new system. This is a 21 centimeter block of single crystal silicon inside of a passive shield, inside of an active shield, all in vacuum. And this is a system that takes about a week to equilibrate. And so the 5 nanokelvin stability is no problem. And so that does not limit the length either. What actually limits the length is something called Brownian noise. And what that means is that these mirrors have coatings, and those coatings are at some temperature, and they can vibrate around. And the idea is that if I have, say, a guitar string at room temperature, it's always vibrating a little bit by thermal motion. If I can make that string stiffer and damp less, it vibrates less. And so this is some this is a calculation of how much vibration comes from, say, the block and the coatings and the spacer. And the take home is today we're using this cavity that is good to 16 digits, mostly because of the coating vibrating. And tomorrow, and I actually really mean now, we're setting up the new cavity that's about a factor of 3 better than that. So a cavity that's good to the 17th digit. So that's great. That's awesome. So now that I don't actually work so much on the cavities, I work on the atoms, this makes my life a little harder because now I need to get my atoms to work at these at this many digits. And that's most of the rest of the talk. Are there any questions on that so far? Yes.
The losses on those mirrors, how do they compare with the best, say, LIGO mirrors? That, you know, LIGO has some limitations.
It's the same. Eventually. It's the same limitation. The thermal noise is the same. The difference is if you look at our frequency stability over length versus LIGO's stability over length, LIGO is doing a bit better because the laser is much, much bigger when it hits the mirrors. So these are very high frequency fluctuations. So I have some coding, and it has very short range high frequency fluctuations all over the place. So the bigger my laser, the better I can average over it. So our beam on the mirrors is small because we have a short cavity. LIGO's beams are large, but it ends up being the same limitation, at least for LIGO at high frequencies, or mid to high frequencies. Both we and LIGO, in one of LIGO's bands, it's the same limitation. So actually, both we and LIGO are very interested in new codings, new approaches, and so forth. So some of the new technology is actually stuff we can take advantage of first. So the idea of using single crystal, the idea of more advanced codings, is stuff we can take advantage of before LIGO does. Because we only need small mirrors and they need big mirrors.
What's the wavelength of this?
For our current cavity, the one I'm talking about here is a 698 nanometer cavity, a laser, because that's the frequency of our atoms. For the new silicon stuff, 698 nanometers doesn't go through silicon, so this is all at 1550. And then we need to bring it down to our atoms with the frequency comb. So it's a bit more complicated. So we have three cavities. We have our room temperature one. The single crystal silicon is shown here as 124 Kelvin. And then we also have a 4 Kelvin system that is very experimental test bed. The problem is at 4 Kelvin, you get rid of a ton of your thermal noise. But now you have a 4 Kelvin fridge that's vibrating and is noisy and is actually just, not only can you hear it, it's actually annoyingly loud when you're in that room, which is not good for cavities. But we're learning how to deal with that. All the temperatures. Any other questions? Yes?
The Q factor of silicon frequencies may be a source of noise. This means the vibration.
So it turns out the substrate itself, silicon is this. It's a single crystal silicon. It's incredibly rigid, which is great. So the actual Q factor and the thermal noise of the spacer of this 21 centimeter thing really doesn't merit so much for us. It's very low. It's a very rigid stiff object. It turned out it's a Q factor of the few microns of the mirror coating, which incidentally is, like we said before, is the same thing that limits LIGO. What limits LIGO is the 5 microns of mirror coating on each side vibrating.
The power, the laser inside, that means there are gradient thermal in the mirror.
Oh yes, that has to be very well stabilized. So the problem with cryogenic stuff is your specific heat drops like whatever, T cubed. So any excess load on this is really bad. So we do limit, I believe currently we have about 100 nanowatts of input power. And so you multiply that by 10 to the 5. 10 milliwatts or so. But we make sure we stabilize the amount of circulating power. So we keep the amount of circulating power always exactly the same. And we've been trying, when you change it around, you can see the cavity length change a little bit. But we're currently working in a regime where it should be fine. Unfortunately, if your laser ever unlocks, then the cavity length of the cavity will slowly drift away. And then you have to bring it back. So, but the nice thing is for this technology, it just never unlocks. We just keep it locked for weeks, or at this point, months, I suppose.
So you said you have to keep correcting the laser every few seconds.
Yes.
So how are you correcting it? Through what procedure?
This cavity, its length cannot be adjusted, and you cannot add adjustments to it without destroying everything. So you simply have a nonlinear crystal that is a frequency shifter that you pretty much on paper keep track of. So the last element right before the laser hits our atoms is we have one of these acousto-optical modulators So we combine light with some radio frequency signal, and then we just change that radio frequency signal around to stabilize it. And this is effectively a paper lock in that we always just keep track on a sheet of paper of the difference between the atoms and the cavity. But this is perfectly useful. We've done frequency comparisons with others. They keep track of their frequency difference, and that's how we compare.
And that nonlinear crystal doesn't introduce its own uncertainty?
Sure, of course it does. Everything introduces an uncertainty, and you calibrate it out. So it turned out every time you turn on and off, you change the power in the nonlinear crystal, it thermally expands, and that thermal expansion gives a frequency chirp. And so it's on the chart. We have a chart of the whatever dozen things we worry about, and that one is not so high on the chart. Everything's a problem.
Of course. Yeah.
Any other questions? Good. So atoms. Told you I have a laser that's good to 16, 17 digits. For the atoms, they're the last things you worry about. You worry about all the things that makes this transition blurred out. Things like how the atoms are moving and interaction and so forth. And then you worry about all the things that makes this transition in my lab different than the transition in everybody else's lab. The first thing, the blurring, is called stability or precision. The second thing is accuracy. This accuracy I will not talk about much in the lab, but it's dominated in our system by black body radiation, which means we are sitting in a 300 Kelvin lab. That 300 Kelvin lab moves the frequency of our atoms at the 15th digit. And so to get our clock at the 18th digit, we need to know exactly what the infrared load is from our lab. And so we measure that to a fraction of a part in a thousand. And that was pretty much the topic of a whole nother talk. And if you want to know about it, I can tell you, but I'm not going to discuss it so much today. But it turned out this is a limitation of strontium clocks today. The things I'm going to tell you about are these elements. So this sort of gets to 3D clock. How do you get are the 19 digits of precision? And the trick is you do it in stages. So this is, say, this isn't really the frequency of strontium because frequencies are defined with cesium, and cesium is only defined or can be measured to 16 digits. But maybe one day this will be the definition of strontium. And so the first six digits are pretty trivial. You take some lamp, some hot gas of strontium, and you get it to discharge, and you put it on a prism, and you can measure things to six digits, pretty much no problem. And the reason you're at six digits is because at 300 Kelvin, you start to get Doppler shifts. So what that means is I have some, say, laser hitting some atom, and I have some two-level system. And if the atom is moving towards my laser, that, of course, blue shifts my transition. My laser is now at too high of a frequency. If it's moving away, it's at too low of a frequency. And so the thermal motion of my atoms give me a blurring of this line. And at 300 Kelvin, that's at the sixth digit. And of course, in the atomic community, we know how to solve that since the 80s. You do laser cooling. So laser cooling, I won't discuss this. I'm happy to discuss details like this ad nauseum if you want to discuss later. That pretty much moves you down to about the 12th digit. So at 1 microkelvin, which is a pretty typical laser cooling temperature, you are now at the 12th digit of your clock. And what that looks like is if I take my laser and I change the frequency of my laser, and I measure, say, I haven't shown a y-axis, how many atoms I excite, when I have a few microkelvin temperature atoms, I get some many kilohertz wide transition. So, okay, that's not great. And you improve that. And the way you improve that is by doing this trick called an optical lattice. So I'll tell you why that works in a moment. But the idea is if I put the atoms in some corrugated potential, I put the atoms in some periodic potential, and I make it very shallow, the first order, you get some really cool, weird line shape that has all sorts of great physics. From a kondensmeyer point of view, you get band gaps, you get Van Hove singularities, all sorts of cool stuff that we do not want in the clock community. So if you make this trap deeper and deeper, you end up with a very simplified spectrum where that broad line I showed you turned into an incredibly sharp, narrow line. And this gets you down to about the Hertz level. And the reason is if I zoom into one of these sites, this pretty much looks like a harmonic oscillator. And what we have done counterintuitively is we have made the energy of motion a very high energy scale. You put the atom in a very, very tight harmonic oscillator, in this case, a 40 kilohertz tight harmonic oscillator. So now when I take an atom and I excite it, I actually can now resolve the motion. So the logic here, and this is something we do a lot, By making an energy scale that's bothering us much larger, we end up being able to resolve it. And so now I can, for example, derive transitions that increase the quantum motion. That's this guy. I can derive transitions that don't change the quantum motion. That's the incredibly narrow peak in the middle. I can derive transitions that lower the quantum motion, but atoms are so cold there aren't very many atoms I can lower their motion. So that's 1D. We've done this now in 3D. This is our upgrade from a couple years ago, where we now have traps where we have an optical standing wave. We do that by having counterpropagating laser beams in along the x direction, along the y direction, along the z direction. And what we see now is we have some harmonic oscillator that's anisotropic. So when I try to drive motion, I can drive quanta along the x, the y, and the z direction until you get a few sharp peaks. And we've been working to make these even sharper. And the technology like this is what's allowed us to push it down to the last digit. And the reason actually isn't just because of freezing out the motion, but now this gives us three-dimensional ground state motion of our atoms. I should mention, in our new experiment, we never ever see anything down here. This is a signature of how many atoms are not in the ground state of our system, and there pretty much aren't any, because we make our atoms really cool. But the last element of the story, it turned out, is interactions. So when we took our laser, another schematic of this cavity, and we used our old setup, a one-dimensional lens, where we only did this trick in 1D, what we used to observe a number of years ago was some beautiful Hertz line shape. And this is, again, I'm changing the frequency of a laser, I'm seeing how many atoms I can excite, has everything to do with the atoms and nothing to do with the laser. And that's because in each of these pancakes, there's a lot of atoms. We want a lot of atoms to make a good measurement. But in each of these, there's many different ways I can excite atoms. There's many configurations with which they can interact. And there's a lot of physics in here I'm going to gloss over. But the idea is that these black delta functions show different configuration energies of, say, different pancakes, or maybe within a pancake. And we can't really resolve them, so we get some blurred, broadened, and shifted line shape.
How many atoms
do you have per set? In that old experiment, it was about 20, 10 to 20, in that picture I showed you. Well, we don't really do that anymore because now we work in a three-dimensional lattice. And what this does is, like for the motion, counterintuitively, when we have a three-dimensional trap, the wave function overlap between two atoms on a site is very large. So it actually means interactions are now a large energy scale. And that effectively resolves all of these peaks. And this actually, again, the counterintuitive thing is we make a very large interaction energy scale that allows us to resolve them and then allows us to build a better clock. So if we look at this in our experiment, if I have one atom on some lattice site, and I can drive that transition, and that gives me this yellow curve peak that's very sharp. This is, again, kilohertz, so our 12th digit length scale. If I have two atoms, I get a peak here and a peak here. That's because when I put one atom in the excited state, either the first atom is ground and the second one is excited, or the first one is excited and the second one is ground, and there's a plus or a minus sign on that, and that gives two different peaks. Or sometimes, and what we're studying right now in the lab, is if I have three atoms, there's more configurations, so we actually get a few more peaks. And this is all kilohertz energy and is totally resolved. And so we can then go in and zoom way into this peak and actually get down to 200 millihertz. So taking this axis and zooming in by, 4 orders of magnitude. And this is now limited by our laser beam, no longer limited by our atoms. Or you do Ramsey, like I showed you in the beginning, on the same experiment, and you get these beautiful sub-100 millihertz. And this is why I'm talking about sort of the 16th, 17th digit of the clock, our sub-100 millihertz features. So that's how we get clocks down to those digits. To show you, because I know there's some theorists here who may want, sometimes people like to see what an experiment actually looks like rather than the abstract. This is from 2 years ago. This is Nelson, our master's student, and Blaine, one of our machinists, and there's, I think, a grad student's head peeking in the background, Ross. This is our vacuum chamber from a couple years ago that we were moving into the lab. It's entirely suspended from one point there, which is kind of scary. You can see Sarah, the lead grad student, this before it touched the table. This is what I call when religion meets science here. You can see there's all sorts of little metal wires here. These are magnetic field coils, just look cool, and we're starting to use these. Inside of here, we have a microscope, which I'll talk about in a minute. Yeah, so there are sort of all the little bits of the lab. I'm, of course, not showing the other 99%. Yes?
Can I ask it this way? So the yellow line is the nominal frequency of the atom barring any outside interactions, because we have
so large. Yeah.
Well.
So I'm asking, I guess, about accuracy. So what are you trying to fix now? You fix this stuff.
So in everything I'm showing here, we're only really thinking about precision. So the center of the line is what we call temporarily zero. But it may not be the same thing that another lab would measure at zero.
Okay.
So the history here is before we put in that experiment I just showed you, we did a big accuracy evaluation of our clock, and we went through all the terms we could figure out and got it down to about 2 parts in 10 to the 18. And then we said, that's great, that was really hard, that was a lot of work. Let's just tear this apart and do something totally different. So that's a new machine I just showed you. Is we have temporarily stopped working on accuracy. We're now working on precision. What time is this? Okay. So, cool. Good? I figure I started around 11:20 something.
Yeah.
Probably go to around there.
I'm keeping time. You have another.
Okay,
you
great.
Have another 20
minutes. Great. Are there any questions on this so far? Before I switch gears. Cool. It's all perfectly clear how you build an optical clock.
The black body radiation that was there before is still here.
Absolutely. So everything is shifted. So, sorry, I should go back 2 slides. Ah, too many transitions in here. There we go. This zero is my temporary zero. This is actually shifted by 2 hertz because of black body radiation.
I see. 2 hertz.
It's huge. So the black body radiation is a 10 to the minus 14, 10 to the minus 15 effect that we have to understand down to the 10 to the minus 18 level. And so that means that this 300 Kelvin room temperature of the lab, we have to determine what that temperature is absolutely at a 10 millikelvin level, which is 10 millikelvin changes in room temperature are trivial to measure. 10 millikelvin absolute temperatures are hard to measure. So we collaborated with the Nith-Geisersberg lab. They gave us 2 absolutely calibrated thermometers against their own standards. We put them in our chamber. We compared them to each other. We moved 1 thermometer around to measure how the black body load changes spatially. We put everything in a big box and closed up for 12 hours to let everything equilibrate. We did all of those things. And so we decided to stop doing those things and build a new experiment. So this brand new, beautiful chamber, for fun reasons, has absolutely no thermometers in it.
Oh.
Yes.
After you've done this, calibrated the temperature,
yes.
How well do the temperatures of the vacuum chamber agree, measured at different spaces?
Within the chamber. So I can move my thermometer by about 1 inch within the chamber.
Uh-huh.
You guys know what an inch is. This is Canada, I guess. and they agree, oh God, I don't remember the temperature changes. I mean, it was hitting millikelvin.
Okay.
So now, the top and bottom of the chamber might actually be at a bit different temperature. But if you're inside of the chamber and you're moving around that thermometer, it ends up not mattering so much.
In other words, you have temperature gradients of the
absolutely
millikelvin per inch or something.
Within of the black body load within the chamber. Okay. Now the chamber itself has temperature gradients on the order of a fraction of a kelvin.
Okay.
But I believe if you know the gradients, if the gradients are less than a kelvin and you know them within about 0.1 kelvin, you're actually good to go, is what all our modeling told us. But the poor other strontium clock in our lab is now doing this on their chamber, so they're learning the pain of controlling gradients. So they're actually putting temperature stabilization all around their chamber to actively cancel gradients.
So just this may be totally stupid,
yes.
But I'm just trying to see whether I understand this. So why wouldn't you just have a cold shroud inside the chamber?
Because that's hard.
Because that's hard, right? Okay.
Yes. So that, in my personal opinion, that's the next generation of clocks. The next generation is it has to be entirely cryogenic. Now there is a cryogenic clock in Tokyo in Katori's group that is a nice, beautiful little cryogenic shield with 2 little holes in it to put atoms in, and those 2 little holes utterly dominate the uncertainty. And they're not even, and so their uncertainty is no bigger than ours. So tiny little holes are not good enough. You need to really enclose it. And then you start worrying, one of the biggest uncertainties we have is comparatively short wavelength radiation. Radiation around 2.6 microns is a big problem for us because we have a transition around there. And so a cryogenic shroud is not good enough to block all wavelengths. You need to understand how to deal with those. So there's a lot of technical reason why this is hard.
So who knows? Yeah.
So you need to get the entire blackbody spectrum down, and that's so it's not good enough just to put it in a cold box. Yeah.
Are you controlling for light shifts with like magic wavelength?
Oh, absolutely. So, the joke in the lab is the last three papers we wrote all involved magic wavelength determinations. So this is saying I'm holding the atom with the laser. Does that laser cause a problem? The answer is obviously yes. How well can I control that? And what we have is we have a potential for atoms that, you know, of some yay, whatever, tens of microkelvin level, that we need to make that potential identical for our two states within about 10 parts per billion. So that's a lot of work, and we need to do that, and we, of course, do that. And the joke right now is that every single paper we publish also involves an evaluation of that. And unfortunately, every time we sit down in a meeting and we try and prove things, the new paper also involves an evaluation of that. So absolutely, this is critical for us. This is the second biggest uncertainty that we have. And so I'm not going to show it today. I have backup slides if you want to see. But we just came up with new synchronous ways of measuring this within a lattice of how can we measure atoms in the middle versus atoms on the edge and evaluate these shifts much more rapidly. And this is an ongoing effort in the lab. There's a lot of shifts I'm not talking about. But I'm glad to talk about them if people want to know. So maybe I'll tell you about atom-atom coherence. So I showed you. Yes.
In the 3D lattice, how many atoms can be loaded?
The other advantage that I'll get to in a minute is we can load a lot more atoms. Because we've gotten rid of these, so there is a precision accuracy trade-off. If I load more atoms and I have this setup, more atoms causes a bigger interaction shift. So I have a trade-off. I either choose more atoms and get more precise but lower accuracy, or I flip it around. With this 3D system, we've solved that problem pretty much. We can put more and more atoms in, and because of this resolved energy shift, we can see them. We also can work towards a Mott insulator, which is a way of suppressing this. And so when we really run our clock, we end up working in a regime where we don't even have two atoms per size because they're suppressed by Mott insulator physics. The old 1D last clocks, we could run up to a few thousand atoms. Now we're running at around 10 to the 4 atoms. And we've certainly loaded 10 to the 5 into the system. So I think it's a very scalable solution. The limitation is laser power. So the atoms are actually much more compact than they used to be. Actually, I'll have a photo of that in a moment. But tens of microns is the size of the atom cloud. I'll actually show you that in a moment. Because we have a microscope. So this is our 3D lattice, under propagating beams along X, along Y, along Z, aligning these. You have to align these every day. It takes a little while. It's a little bit annoying. But what we were doing before I was showing you is atom light coherence, where we do, this is another view of this Ramsey sequence. I put the atoms in a superposition. I wait for some number of seconds. I read out that superposition. But what we've added now is a big microscope to the system. So we can not only ask, on average, how many atoms are we exciting? We can also see where they are. And so we end up loading these pancake-shaped samples. And this is the answer to your question, about between 60 and 80 microns across. We're looking down at our sample. What you can't see is the vertical dimension is a couple of microns. So a very compact sample. And we can now take a picture of where are those atoms in the ground state? Where are those atoms in the excited state? And in these pictures, we've improved on this. You can see maybe if you squint a little bit, on the bottom left, there's a few more atoms in the ground state. On the top right, there's a few more atoms in the excited state. It's because of the very small frequency shift across this lattice. So what we do is we take a hint from our atom interferometry friends. They have difficulty measuring, as you will probably hear about later today, they have difficulty measuring superpositions of atoms in different motional states in the background, in the presence of acceleration noise. So this has actually turned out a good way to get rid of laser noise. And the way it works is as follows. On the top right, I have some frequency. On the bottom left, I have a different frequency in that box. So when I run my experiment, one of them gives me a sine wave, which is a blue. The other one gives me a sine wave, which is a red. And maybe my laser isn't good enough to see this. So what we do is we say, set the laser to some, I know, arbitrary value. I'll call this arbitrary value 0. And we measure up here and down there what fraction of atoms are excited. Maybe more were excited on this curve than that curve. So on a parametric plot, I put on a point. This is one run of my experiment. The next run, my laser jumps to another frequency, whatever, it happens. And on this parametric plot, I measure how many atoms are excited here versus there, and I put another point, and put another point. And if I fill in this curve, this gives me a parametric plot of one sine wave versus a shifted sine wave. That's an ellipse. So if we run this for our experiment, we can measure one region versus another region, actually a very high contrast. And what this tells us is the atom light contrast, coherence, I should say, was suffering from the laser drifting around and jumping around, and from other problems that we're studying. The atom-atom coherence, this is saying, what is the quantum mechanical superposition of an atom in this region versus that region? These are, as far as I'm concerned, a well-separated region. The atoms don't talk to each other. And we see very high coherence between the two. That's saying we can preserve the quantum mechanical state of these very well over the course of many seconds. And in addition, the geometry of this ellipse tells me very accurately what's the frequency here versus there. So if we improve that, this is actually data from a better ellipse than this one. If I measure this over and over and over, I see in two parts of my trap, maybe I get a 5 millihertz frequency difference, and I can determine the center very well. And so this is where we can measure, say, that the two frequencies in this run were off by 130 parts in 10 to the 19, and we know that to within 3 parts in 10 to the 19. So that's where this 19th digit is coming from that I was advertising. This is showing the precision you get when you compare one region of atoms versus another region. And the reason this works very well is all of the measurements I'm showing you here, and I'm not going to show you why, I have backup slides if you want, are what's called Adam-Schott noise limited. So if I take 6,000 atoms, as is used in this experiment, there is some quantum mechanical noise from my 6,000 atoms. Each one is an independent realization of the experiment. And for 6,000 atoms and 6 seconds and this kind of coherence, we are measuring as well as we possibly can. And that's where we're getting our huge boost in precision. This turns out to be a 10 to the minus 18 measurement in about 15 minutes, which is much better than we were doing in the past. This 3 to the minus 19 is nearly 3 hours of measurement time. So that turns out to be very fast in this community. And it turns out, I'm not going to go into detail, but something we're currently trying to understand is this. The fact that atoms are not, why aren't the atoms 100% coherent over this number of seconds? Why do we not measure something that's perfect? And the reason is the atoms are in this trap, and every once in a while they can scatter photons from the light that holds them. And until this work, the knowledge and the understanding in the field is the way you build a good clock is you always put the atoms in a very deep, tight trap. It's called the Lamb-Dickey limit. That's how you should always build a clock. And what we're now finally understanding is this doesn't work anymore. Because the atoms, if they're in a really deep trap, that's a lot of light that's decohering those atoms. And so what we have to start thinking about is how are we going to build a clock in the future? How can we build a clock that's no longer in such a deep trap? How do we get by with a lot less laser power? I'm not going to talk about that. I'm happy to share ideas sort of on the side. But this is something that's really actually, surprisingly, this simple measurement here has really started to challenge our understanding of what we should be building in the future. The way this looks, by the way, I showed you atom light coherence before versus ions versus microwave clocks. This atom-atom comparison is a curve here. It's averaging down much faster. So in about 3 hours, this is equivalent to a 4 millimeter gravitational redshift. Of course, this experiment is done horizontally, so there is no gravitational redshift. But you imagine this technique can be used to actually bring gravitational redshifts down to the millimeter level, so within the same chamber. Any question on that? This is sort of what we've been working on the last few months, so perhaps it's a little bit of a less polished presentation.
4 millimeter gravitational redshift. 4 millimeter in wavelength of light.
Oh no, 4 millimeters. If I took, right. If I took this system, and right now it's horizontal, if I made a vertical and I spaced those out, I could see something over about 4 millimeters. Which means that now we can actually think about testing, now we can consider testing the gravitational redshift within a single chamber, which would be nice. And so what's next? Where am I on time? A couple more minutes. Are there any questions on that? Yes.
Sorry.
Yeah.
For your ellipse data.
Yes.
The two little squares.
Yes.
Have you looked at like the structure of that? Is beyond, like how did you like spatially? How does it vary across the cloud?
So this picture is a gradient. if you work at, I wonder if I have nice pictures, some really nice pictures I have of when it's interesting. Here we go. If you, for example, there was a question about magic wavelengths before. The atoms in the middle of this are at the deepest part of our trap. As you walk away from the middle, they get into a shallower part of the trap. So if you make your trap so that it doesn't exactly trap ground and excited state atoms exactly the same way, then you end up with these beautiful rings. So atoms are excited in the middle, they're excited out here on some distance, they're excited again. And so this is, it turned out to be an incredibly sensitive measurement of whether we're at what's called the magic wavelength, which is the wavelength of our laser where the ground and excited state atoms are trapped exactly the same way. So this is a pattern that we intentionally put on the atoms. We recently upgraded this, a few upgrades to the system where we improved a lot of our optics, and this weird gradient that we had here has now gone away. And so in order to bring it back, we're actually applying magnetic field gradients. So if you want another interesting structure, let's see. Here we go. If you apply a magnetic field gradient, and this is a map of fraction of atoms that end up in the excited state, you can get a nice trappy pattern. That's pretty cool. Also lets us calibrate things. This is what we're currently, this is from last Tuesday. So recent results in the lab. Any other questions?
Yeah, sorry, do you have a requirement of how horizontal this thing has to be?
It turned out to be a slightly non-trivial problem. Turns out if you make it too horizontal, then atoms can resonantly tunnel from one side to the next. And that's bad for the clock. So, but sometimes you want it. If you want to, say, build a quantum simulator, you need to level that out. So we have, it is definitely not flat at the, it's probably tilted by some fraction of a degree, which is good for our current results. But for this, yeah, we actually want everything a little bit tilted.
Can you say with the intuition, is this because it's like flat, it's purely periodic, at least?
Yes, it is perfectly pure. If it were flat,
then
you describe the system. Whenever I talk about harmonic oscillator levels, this is a crude approximation. This is a periodic potential, and if it were flat, the correct solution would be bands.
Yeah.
And so the condensed matter view of our experiment is when we go to a very deep lattice, we end up with some band structure, say, zero, Q equals pi over A for the ground state, and some similar structure for the excited state, and we drive transitions that are non-vertical, because when the atoms pick up a photon, they get a momentum kick. And the width of this band tells you the width of your clock line. So you want to make this as flat as possible. But when you make it really flat, you do that by using as much laser power as you have, and that starts to decohere the atoms because they start to scatter light. And that's where we're currently stuck. And it turned out you can do a little bit better by intentionally tilting this. So you don't describe these by Planck states anymore. You describe them by what are called Vanier-Stark states. And the extreme is if you just tilt it vertically, then one layer to the next layer had a detuning of about 800 hertz. So very, very large detuning. Which actually means if we just do a very small angle, we're good to go. But we don't actually know how flat we're currently at, and that's on the list of things to measure. Any other questions?
Yes. So your limitation on the short noise is from the number of atoms, and that depends on how many you can trap? And
Yes. So we currently, in order to load the ground state of our lattice, we do something called evaporative cooling, which is a standard technique known in the BEC or quantum degenerate gas. I should mention, these are quantum degenerate fermions that we're using. We're at a T over TF of about 0.1. So they're very, very cold atoms. And so there is a trade-off on the temperature and how many atoms we end up getting. And we have found experimentally that as we go to higher temperatures, something bad is happening. We're not sure what that is. We believe it is thermal occupation of higher bands that are now mobile. So the atoms are only pinned in the lowest band, and higher bands they can start to move around. We're not really sure, and we're in the middle of exploring this. But the 6,000 is, these rectangles are only 1,000 each. The 6,000 is a slightly bigger bigger rectangles. This is about 2,000 in those two rectangles. We can boost the atom number up. But ultimately, we're starting to get in, really, we're running into the limit of how big our laser beams are and how many atoms we can evaporatively cool. In a three-dimensional lattice compared to a one-dimensional lattice, you have automatically cut your laser power in three. And you need to be able to align these lasers to each other, and everything ends up being way smaller than we would like. So we have as much power in this experiment as money can currently buy us, which is 2 6-watt Thai sapphire lasers. It'd be great if we could upgrade that, but you're still talking about, I guess that averages out to about $20,000 per watt. And so we have 12 watts, and continuing that is expensive.
Excuse me.
Yes.
You may have mentioned this, I didn't pay attention. Are you free from vibration of the laboratory?
So we suppress that the best we can. And one of the very nice things about optical lattice clocks is that this is a good slide. I told you we make a standing wave with two counterpropagating lasers. We do this by sending one laser in, having a mirror, and retroreflecting it. And so the vibrations of that mirror sets the Doppler shift of the atoms. So when we send our clock light to the experiment, we use the same mechanical mount of that mirror to reference the clock light. So as that mirror vibrates around, we take our clock and we jitter it exactly in phase with that. And we believe at the 18th digit, that's pretty good. There is some speculation from the NIST team on their ytterbium clocks that around the 18th digit, maybe we're not quite doing it right. But so far, it seems pretty good. The nice thing is that because the atoms are in a very tight trap, they're in a 40 kilohertz tight trap, there's very little ambient vibration at that frequency. But we also track it. That, by the way, 10 to the minus 18 Doppler shifts are angstrom per second, which is slower than your fingernail growing. So these are small Doppler shifts that we do worry about, but we track them. Am I out of time?
Officially, yes, but you can continue.
I'll go a couple minutes over then. What else do we have? Maybe, what's next? This is interesting. You can make bare clocks, cryogenic setups, and so forth. You can study many-body physics. This is something, again, near and dear to my heart, though perhaps less applicable for this workshop. And then you can start to do fundamental physics with this. And what we're thinking about, of course, is ideas from Mina and others. And what you do is you take some chart, and I'm sure this is a very small fraction of dark matter particles, and you find, is there any region of this chart where clocks can say anything at all? And it turns out, as Mina told you before, if you're talking about axions, but not QCD axions, maybe axion-like axions that are dark matter, maybe that's something that clocks can inform. And so the approach is, just to sort of reiterate the first talk, but maybe more from my point of view, our approaches to this problem are always kind of follow a two birds with one stone approach. So what that says, that I find some physics problem that has nothing to do with dark matter. Maybe the hierarchy problem. Okay, why are some forces so much weaker than other forces? I try to solve this problem. And I find some solution to this problem that is, again, unrelated to dark matter. And maybe one thing is that I have fundamental constants, and they're not constants. They're set by expectation values of some field. And the logic is that one atmosphere maybe, okay, one atmosphere is an officially defined unit, but one atmosphere is in the atmosphere in this room. You measure that, and that's not a fundamental constant of nature. That is an emergent property of statistical mechanics. And you know that because if you get a really good pressure sensor and you measure today versus tomorrow, it's going to be different. That's sort of one good hint. So you try measure. So maybe fundamental constants aren't so constant. And you see whether the solution to that problem also, incidentally, gives you dark matter. So now you have a dark matter candidate that has some predictions besides just gravitational coupling that the astronomers tell us about. And so now that you have a dark matter candidate, you have some extra property to search for, which in this case is fundamental constants fluctuating. The question is, if I take two atoms and I compare the frequency of these two atoms, and the fundamental constant changes, can I see that? Which, of course, is something that has been previously published and searched for. How do we do that? Well, I should mention what we're good at is a fine structure constant that's known to about 10 digits, and I think later today we're going to hear more about that. But we know the 17th digit of this number. I don't know what the 17th digit is. Nobody does. Maybe it's a 4. Who knows? Whatever that number is, it's not changing. But we don't know beyond that. And so the question that we have is, by comparing our atoms to a macroscopic object of our laser, can we see this? And so we have hydrogenic atoms. So a hydrogenic atom is something like alpha squared times the rest mass of an electron. And as Meenam also mentioned, if you ask what is the energy of a photon that's resonant with this, well, that depends on the length of this cavity in terms of the number of atoms and in terms of the Bohr radius, and it gives you an alpha mc squared. And so we are linearly sensitive to fluctuations in the fine structure constant. And so we start thinking about, in one day of averaging in our system, these are the very nice results from Berkeley and from CERT of atom-atom comparisons. If I simply compare my atoms versus my cavity, we can start to see if we can cut into this parameter space a bit more. We can ask, are there ways to measure high frequency components? And so there are indeed ways we can measure fine structure variations at high frequencies. And this is something that we're currently gearing up to do a little bit later this year with our new cavity. And so the conclusion really is, this applies, I normally throw in the beginning of my talk, and I forgot to today. Clocks in the 50s were at the 10th digit. Now we're down to the 18th digit. I see absolutely no reason why this is not going to continue improving. We are nowhere near hitting the limit of strontium optical last clocks. And I've told you about our record accuracy to the minus 18, our record coherence time of hitting 6 seconds, the record stabilities of getting to the 19th digit, and a little bit about a dark matter search. And so, as I mentioned in the beginning, this is a team effort with this fantastic group of students. And of course, thank you all for your attention. So we had a lot of questions during the talk. Are there any more? Yes?
How big is the mean field shift from all the other atoms in the
clock? Well, the great thing is these are degenerate fermions. So in cesium clocks, for example, you get mean field shifts because they're bosons. They're all in the same state. They have S-wave scattering. If we do all of our cooling with some spin mixture where we can get S-wave shifts. And the data I showed you were huge S-wave shifts from having two atoms on one site. But if they're on different sites, there's no collisions. And anyway, we spin polarize this thing, so there's no S-wave collisions anymore. We are only with P-wave. And so in this 3D clock, the mean field shift from anything collisional is pretty much gone. So the next order term is long-range electric-electric dipole. So this is saying I have, you know, I excite my atom to some G plus E superposition. That superposition can hop around. I have a millihertz clock transition, so I can't hop around very well. But that is expected to give a 10 to the minus low 18s, high 19s kind of shift. So that's the next thing to look for. But for the collisional shifts people worry about, we're done with them in this 3D clock. Yeah?
Yeah. At what point does Newtonian noise start to...
What do you mean by Newtonian noise?
Just you walking around in the lab and your presentation on here.
Shockingly, because... So the old 1D clocks, we spread the atoms out over about half a millimeter. The new system is very compact. The atoms are all in a really, really tiny volume. So the gravitational gradients are completely negligible.
No.
What's surprising...
It's a radiation noise. Newtonian noise they're talking about. Newtonian noise.
What do you mean by Newtonian noise?
By near field.
Near field gravity?
Yeah. We're not talking about gravitational waves from you. So.
I assume the question is whether the local gravitational environment of the lab from us walking around to the prom, and the answer is not currently, because the samples are so small. So really the relevant number is I need to separate the sample by 4 millimeters just to detect a little g. So it's one of those really funny things where we're really proud that we can see little g over a short length scale, whereas these guys are really proud they see 10 digits of little g. So we're not really at the atom interferometry level, but we are measuring something different. Well, arguably. Well, or maybe not, actually. That's another debate not to enter.
We do our best to cancel the transition frequency.
Yes. Fair enough. Right. So they try to amplify a little g, we try to amplify the optical frequency. We're all measuring the same. It's all atom light coupling at the end of the day.
Any more questions?
Yes.
I'm having a hard time to understand the relation between the atomic cloud and dark matter switch.
Right. So the relation is that one of the models for dark matter that Mina and Ken and others have proposed is that dark matter can couple to the fine structure constant. And this is something that maybe I should eventually turn the stage over because you guys, of course, know this much better than I do. But the idea is that there's, if it's an axion-like, not necessarily a QCD axion, but an axion-like dark matter, one of the simple ways that a scalar spin zero dark matter can couple is through alpha. And we're really good at measuring alpha. So I cannot ever calculate the frequency of strontium from first principles, but I do know how it depends on fundamental constants. Any other questions? Yes.
This is wild, but so if this thing is, remember we're talking about the tilt and the fact that if you are perfectly horizontal, does it mean that if you change the tilt periodically in some way, you can actually parametrically?
Oh, sure.
Something interesting.
Absolutely.
But that's coupled to gravity. Is that there's nothing interesting.
Whoa. Oh. So we've been thinking about that from a very different context, which is our context has been, I have those band structures. How do I get rid of them? And one thing you can do is you can periodically shake the lattice. In that case, you don't measure energy, you measure flow okay, states. And it is well known in the many body community, you can call something called dynamic localization. That's actually where we're coming from this. But I could imagine if I wanted, and I think this is how, I believe this is how some big G experiments work, if I had some mass distribution in the lab that I could periodically change around, then I could look for resonant peaks rather than just shifts. But I don't think we're there yet. Neither of those may have been the answer to your question, though.
No, it's I don't.
We can talk about it afterwards.
I don't know what the question was in some sense.
But those are two answers to different questions.
Okay.
Any last, maybe we should, last question or so? I guess I am the last thing before lunch, so.
Okay.